If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, the podcast where we unravel the threads of contemporary textile art. I'm Mr. X Stitch, and in today's episode, I'm talking to the incredible Rosie James, a machine embroidery artist known for capturing fleeting human moments in stitch. Rosie's work is all about movement, liminality, and the stories that unfold in public spaces. This is the first part of our Needle Exchange, and we explore Rosie's artistic journey from her background in textile design to her discovery of free motion embroidery. We talk about the influence of photography on her work. We talk about the philosophy of waiting and how she translates the energy of crowds into textile art. If you enjoyed this episode, then you're going to also want to listen to episodes 73 and 74 with Harriet Riddle, another machine-stitched storyteller. I'll be back next week with the second part of the conversation, but if you've enjoyed this one, feel free to share it with somebody who will also appreciate it. Thanks very much. See you next week. I had an interesting thing today, which actually, as I was hightailing it back from the gallery, I thought it was an interesting overlap, where I was talking to one of our volunteers and she was talking about absurdism, which I thought was like, she was talking about absurd literature and the idea of absurdism. And I thought it was going to, I said like Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer, because they're pretty absurd. Yeah. And then she said, that's more like Dadaism, at which point I went, clearly, I don't know what I'm talking about now. But bear with me on this, because, and I'm just going to quote something. I asked the internet what absurdism was, and it says, absurdism is a philosophical theory that explores the conflict between humanity's desire to find meaning in life and the universe's apparent lack of inherent meaning or purpose. This tension creates what is known as the absurd. Now, absurdism suggests that while life may be meaningless, individuals should embrace this reality without despair, instead of creating their own meaning through personal choices and actions. Now, bear with me. A classic piece of absurd theatre, apparently, is the play Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett, where people are just waiting and nothing ever really happens. And then I was like, I know a lady who does an awful lot of needlework about people just waiting.
Waiting, yes.
And I thought that was a really interesting, the way that that had all come together. And I thought that was a great place to talk, because one of the things I've always said that I love about your work is just you capture these fleeting moments.
Yeah.
But they're moments of nothing, but you've captured them, so they become moments of something.
Yeah.
And I'd love to get your take on all of that.
Well, it's interesting you point out that people are waiting, because I hadn't really thought of that. But they are, yeah, they're mostly waiting. Or they're sort of sitting around, or they're walking about, but they are kind of absurd, I suppose, isn't it then? Because they're just waiting around, and well, I've captured them, so they're going to be waiting around forever.
Yes.
So if they were waiting for that train at the time, or they were just, a lot of the time though, they are waiting, but then they are, because I use photography. You know, I take a photograph and then I stitch from that. So I've taken a photograph. So I've captured them as they are walking along.
Mm.
Or so they might be walking along. So they might not be waiting, but they kind of then, once I've captured them, they've stopped, haven't they? They're no longer walking along. They're mid-flow.
Mm.
And But the one I'm thinking of is the piece where they're standing on the station waiting for the train. And I started off doing all people in stations because they are there's loads of people and they are not, you're not moving very fast, so they're easy to get pictures of. And those people were stood on that platform in Maidstone. And I sat on the other side so I could get loads of pictures of them. And they were all going to London, so there's absolutely loads of them. And I'm on the other side, where the trains go from London deeper into Kent. There's nobody going that way, really. And so it's a perfect spot. There's loads and loads of people gathered on this platform. But then they sort of could see me sitting opposite, because I was the only person sitting there, and they can see me taking pictures. And they began to, you can see them starting to think, what's she doing?
Yeah.
And then the train came in and they all got on the train and they forgot about it.
Because you also have like liminal moments, like you say, like people, they're not, I mean, and I'm sort of broadly generalising here, but a lot of the time people aren't specifically taking part in an activity. They're going between phases.
Yes.
Like you say, moving around. And I wonder what it is that you find curious about that, where the intrigue comes from.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because the favourite places for people to gather are those what you call liminal bits, aren't they? Where they're, like, I haven't done one yet, but I want to do one in a motorway service station because they're brilliant. You get people just gather there for a bit and then they're off again, aren't they? It's just like this weird space where you, and also it's one of those places where everybody, every kind of person is going to end up in there, whether you're rich or you're poor or you're young or old or whatever. And so it's a really good place for people watching. But the few motorway service stations I've been in lately, they've been packed, absolutely packed. And anyway, yeah, so that's so there's motorway service stations, airports, railway stations, they're all in between spaces, aren't they? They're not. You don't go there for the day. You don't go for a day out in a motorway service station. Well, I don't know. Maybe some people do.
Horses for courses. It made me think of like when you do like meditation stuff, sometimes they get you to concentrate on the bit in between breaths.
And
it's almost akin to that, isn't it? These are places where people are just pausing for a moment or something.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. The bit between breaths.
Yeah, like that's the bit, you know, the breath, the in-breath and the out-breath is like the flow of life, and the bit in between is the stillness.
Yeah.
Like the godliness, maybe.
The bit in between.
Not sure you're going to get godliness on Knutsford services on the M6 or something. It doesn't feel the same.
Yeah. At the moment, I'm looking at airports because this group I'm in, Art Textiles Made in Britain, we have a different theme every couple of years. So this year it's flight. So I thought, perfect, I can go and look at people in airports. And the last airport I was in Athens. Actually, it wasn't the last one, but it was in Athens in October last year. And again, it was absolutely heaving. It was just crazy. So I've got loads of great pictures of people and suitcases and stuff.
And there's some intentional dressing, isn't it? I always think if you're going to go on a plane, you're not dressing naturally. You're dressing slightly strategically, if you've got your wits about you.
Slightly what?
Strategically. You know, maybe you've got the shoes on that you don't want to put into your luggage, or maybe you're dressed for comfort rather because you're going on a long journey.
Yeah, you've got those clothes on that you sort of don't want to put in the bag. That you just, but you want to be comfortable on the plane. And so you see a lot of people wearing, their comfortable clothes that they might loll around in on the settee of a night, and they're wearing them, and they've got all their sort of weird cozy things, you know, the thing to put around your neck and your little things like that. Like they're going to really get comfortable, and they're going to be squashed in a tiny seat on a plane with loads of other people. So you've got to make the most of it, I suppose, haven't you? But yeah, they're really interesting places. And there were so many people. People are sitting on the floor and just sort of practically on top of each other. Crazy.
And is that the thing that interests? Because I guess you're then recreating many of these people using machine embroidery. So you're then retelling the story. And I wonder what it is that makes the story worth retelling in that respect.
Yeah. Well, I suppose what I'm interested in is where you have all these that are all kind of going in a line And they've all gone to this point, this sort of hub, to carry on along that way. And we're all kind of doing that, but we're not really, we're not meeting all these other people. We don't speak to them. You know, we're not, we're just sort of brushing past each other, aren't we? And so there's a weird, it's like a weird moment sort of capturing where we're all kind of like in the same space as all these other people. And then we're all, it's like there's a station in Paris, I think it is, probably Gare du Nord. And when you go down a floor, there's this huge area where there's like a corridors and people are coming in and out and sort of whooshing past each other. And they're all walking very fast and there's a lot of them. And you just think, how are we all doing that without bumping into, we don't, nobody bumps into anybody, nobody, you know. And then, and the, it's sort of like not a narrative, well, it kind of is a narrative, but it isn't, because they're not, they've halted in their journey.
Do you know what it's making me think of is Murmurations?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
They're like human murmurations, aren't they? We're all doing a certain dance, and then we're going to go off and be starlings in a different tree or something.
Yeah, that's, I love that. Human murmurations. Kind of is, isn't it?
Yeah. That'll be the title of your next book. Thanks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, love it. Human murmurations. Yeah, because we all come together, and then we're all perched on the ledge, and we all go whoosh.
Yeah. But you're doing that intricate dance, like you say, all together for a moment or two. And then I don't know whether starlings, whether they're gossiping as they're murmuring or whatever, but it feels like they're very in town where the gallery is. It's quite sweet, but there's lots of pigeons. And every now and again, you get the pigeon version of it, which is a lot smaller and they're a lot bigger. But nonetheless, you just sit and just watch like 40 pigeons all just like flying around together.
Yeah, the pigeons do it, don't they? Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And how do they, don't they, must talk to each other, because, or does one of them go off and they all think, oh God, we better go.
Darren's off. Let's go follow Darren.
Darren's gone. Off we go. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Because there is, I think, I don't know whether there's a science in it, isn't there? But it's almost like no starling is in charge of a murmuration. They're all intuiting it. And it's like a collective intuition that drives the swells and the swoops and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then at some point there's a break.
Like one of them who, yeah, no, they're just all, they all kind of.
Maybe at some point someone goes, the departure gate for London to Zurich is now open, and the birds go, right, go off and land in a tree. There's some version of that.
That's what's weird again, isn't it, at these places, stations and airports. You know, that voice comes out and our little heads go, oh, and then we all go, or some of us jump off in one direction, yeah.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing as well, you imagine, do you know tilt shift photography? You know, when they can do photography and make smaller versions, it's just an optical illusion. Like that sort of thing, tilt shift, slightly sped up versions of that, and we'd all look like we were little minions running around.
Yeah, tilt shift, I've not heard of that.
Yeah, it's the way that they used to do techniques where you could take a photograph of, for instance, a building site or something, and by altering the angle and the perception, it just makes everything look like micro versions. So you're taking photos of like construction sites, but they look like micro machines and that kind of thing.
It's an interesting illusion.
Yeah. But this idea of people and places is, that's persistent. That, to me, that's like classic Rosie Jane.
Yeah. Well, I've been going through all my work and looking at it and thinking it does evolve, but it's always just people and wherever there's a crowd or people doing something. So I might fiddle about with, like recently I've been doing large reflective things.
I've seen those, yeah. High vis.
Yeah, so there's still people doing stuff, because that started when I was walking home at night from City Lit, where I teach sometimes, to the station at St Pancras. And on the road, I don't go that way anymore, but that I used to go past all these construction sites and it would be dark and, or just getting dark, and they're all wearing their high vis and everything. And I became a bit fascinated by all these cranes and people and everything. So I wanted to do something looking at these figures doing this. But then where I live, they were building a whole new housing estate, and there was loads of high vis clothing just chucked at the side of the road. I don't know why they do that. But anyway, I got a collection of high-vis trousers And I've got a really nice, like, dungaree things, high-vis dungarees and jackets and loads of it. So I wanted to do something with that, so I started playing with that. But the reflective stuff is really interesting because when you... I pulled off the reflective strips off these jackets and then cut thinner strips of it, and then I can couch it onto the background with the sewing machine. So I could do large figures and then do the lines with this couched tape, if you like, but only narrow. And then you can buy reflective thread, which I can't get in the needle, but I can put it in the bobbin. So then you can stitch the line, but kind of backwards. And then, but then, what? When you've done that, it just looks grey, because it's just grey. So you have to shine a light on it for it to then reflect. And then you have to be standing in a straight line from it for you to see that reflection. So then I realised that if you take a picture with your phone, it flashes with the flash on, it reflects, and then the image that you get is completely lit up. Mm. So it kind of... I got excited in that whole, you know, reflective stuff and taking pictures, and it was quite... But I was still doing figures, basically. Figures and crowds, but using this other technique, using these different materials. It just allows you to explore different figures doing different things and using different materials, essentially. But, yeah.
Have you come to understand how the reflective material works, like what the science is behind it?
No idea. Well, I did. I did look into it. Really? Forgotten.
Kind of crazy. No, because the interesting thing then, you know, high-vis jackets are meant to be high-vis, aren't they?
Yeah.
But as anyone knows, they also render people invisible.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you want to get up to some mischief, you just put a high-vis jacket on, everyone assumes you work for the council, and then you just can get away with it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny. So you've automatically, again, ended up with a subject matter of people who aren't quite there.
Yeah, that's so true, isn't it? Yeah. You put one of those jackets on and you're just somebody... working, nobody's going to look at you.
Yeah, I think that's how Banksy gets all his work done.
Yeah, he does. He puts a high-vis jacket on.
Yeah, he's also like 55 and middle-aged or whatever now, so he just blends in right good and proper, doesn't he?
But the thing with the guys doing the working on the streets there with the high-vis on, it was very difficult to get good pictures of them because they really didn't like it. If they saw me, you know, they got some... There'd always be somebody there. There'd be the guys working, then there'd be somebody else who's just sort of watching or looking or I don't know what they are. And they'd come over to me and say, "You taking pictures?"
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't like it. I suppose, I don't know.
There's just a funny layer, isn't there? I think about, you know, you just think about councils doing work and the people that the attitude that people have, which is often like they turn up at 9 to go home at 2, council spending loads of money on all this, waste of my taxpayers' money and all that. So I guess there is just this distrust layer that makes it quite difficult to take an innocent photo and go, just fascinated, because you're like a, I don't know, it's almost like they're the birds that pick the food out of the teeth of the hippos or whatever. They're just people fixing the world around us and getting on and doing it, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. They're getting on and doing it. And most of the time they don't notice me taking the pictures, but they don't like it. I think it's just building and construction, isn't it? They don't want people knowing what they're building, very secretive about the whole plans for the building, and, you know, maybe they think I'm going to go in there and put a bomb in it or something.
Job them into English heritage or something.
I might. But what I like about doing them is I've had a lot of people love it. You know, like when you could do an exhibition or something, the men particularly just, you know, and then as soon as they see a picture of a man drilling, it's like, wow, look at that.
Mm.
So it's, you know, different audience. And then if it's reflective as well and you can play with your phone, that's quite fun.
There's an interesting permission there, isn't there? I was doing a presentation recently. I was updating it and I added a picture by an artist called Kiara O'Connor. And it's basically got a couple of ladies in bikinis, but they're on like a junkyard and there's a digger in the background. And in some ways I was like, the piece that she's put together there is really, it gives men a lot of permission to look at it, which is a dumb thing to say because it's almost like a cliche, but sometimes you feel like the strength of needlework and what it represents is so strong that for your average Joe,
Yeah.
Maybe they need a bit. I mean, it's the same as my whole shtick, isn't it? I'm a guy. I do need to work. I haven't been hit by lightning. It's all right. That kind of thing.
Yeah. No, I love it. I like that kind of industrial machines rendered in Stitch, because it's sort of, you know, putting these two things together, which you don't see that often, and, you know, making something so sort of, I don't know what the word is. I was going to say macho, but it's not something that's so industrial, and then making out of something so domestic almost, with embroidery threads and stuff like that. You know, those two things together. Bingo.
I agree. And I think there's that contrast to me is something I find that I respond very well to when someone does bits and pieces. Like there was an artist at the Hand and Lock Prize, Kate Johnston, and she had a chaise longue, and she'd kind of, I think it was machine embroidery as well, but she'd done like traffic jam.
Yeah, brilliant.
On a chaise longue. And the contrast is so great because it's like, I don't know, I was going to say Wainwright, he's not a poet. Constable paintings.
Oh, yeah.
But in the modern context, you know, give me a motorway bridge and I'm probably quite happy about that because that's just a moment of the modern era.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I love that kind of stuff. Yeah, the capturing that just contemporary stuff using all these quite old-fashioned, you know, techniques and quite humble and...
It's the documentary of it as well. Like, and I think that's one of the things that I always cite your work as, is just a form of documentary, because you're not really adding a political layer, are you? You're just taking a photograph, recreating that, and then throwing it out for people to draw their own conclusion.
That is exactly right. It's nothing... They were just there, so I took a picture of them, and now they're stitched. So I've just documented it. Yeah. It's sometimes, yeah, that's all it is. I was trying to think of something to make it sound more complicated, but no, that's basically it.
And do you think it was always like that? Because I know that this your mode of working evolved, didn't it? Because you were a radiographer for 10 years.
Yeah,
so you did a lot of, like, I mean, weirdly, that's also documenting things and looking at things rather abstract, sort of, what is it? It's objectively looking at things rather than subjectively looking at things. But it's taken you a while, isn't it? You did your degree, you did your master's, you started teaching, and around that sort of time, was that when the idea of people and documentary sort of came out?
Well, what happened was, so I did my degree in textiles, so that was all print. So it was all design, and it was all printing. I did lots of printing on fabric, and then I was started... Then I had a little business for a couple of years, making hand-printed scarves and ties and things, but I wasn't really feeling it. And then and also it's difficult to make a living doing that, so I thought I'll get into teaching, and then I can do a bit of teaching whilst doing whatever. So then I thought I better do an MA, so I did the MA. But I did the MA at Goldsmiths, so it's very fine art. So I'd done this design degree, and I was doing this fine art MA. So that was just a big eye-opener for me. It was like, oh, my God, I can do anything, really.
Right.
And then I was started thinking about using textile techniques kind of in a fine art context and looking at... So I was a bit like we're talking about. I looked at artists that did created art that was very kind of industrial, like the minimalists, so Donald Judd and Carl Andre. And so Donald Judd was making these great big boxes out of sort of aluminium, and they were manufactured, you know, so he kind of put together these artworks. There was no trace of the artist's hand in there. They were all manufactured. And then Carl Andre made work out of bricks. So they were kind of a bit macho and a bit industrial and a bit heavy. And so I just started to think about the textile equivalent of that. So in order to think about that, I thought, well, I'll recreate some of these things using fabric. So I recreated Carl Andre's bricks using old curtains. And then I recreated a Donald Judd stack using silk. Exactly the same size and construction, but just using silk instead of aluminium.
Mm.
And then and it was just interesting because then, of course, these stacks made out of silk, they just flopped, you know, they didn't stick out on the wall, they just went. And so they looked, it was just really quite interesting how they worked and how they looked compared to the original minimalist artwork. And so I wanted to carry on thinking about that when I finished my MA. But then I was at home in my studio, little shed, and you're thinking, what do I do now? You know, how do I? And I was drawing, and I was just thinking, so looking at the great masters of drawing, like Rembrandt and Dürer and, you know, Van Gogh, just or looked at their drawings and the way that they drew, and then thought about how can you do something similar to that using like textile techniques of some kind. But at that point, I just did printing, dyeing and printing and, you know, making these structures, but I didn't do any sort of embroidery at all. Somebody asked me to teach. At that point, I was teaching fine art, but with textiles. And then we started running a textile course. So I was teaching textiles, I was teaching screen printing and dyeing and stuff. And then the local adult education asked me if I would teach a machine embroidery course. So, of course, I didn't know anything about machine embroidery. So I said, I don't have a clue. I don't know how to do that. And they said, oh, that doesn't matter. You'll be fine. And you're thinking, what? So then they said, well, you just do the design bit. And then I assumed that we're going to get somebody in to do the actual, you know, practical bit. So I said, oh, okay. And then it got nearer to the time and I thought they haven't. So I contacted them and I said, what's happening? And they said, oh, no, you're going to teach the whole thing. So I said, well, I don't know anything about it. And they just said, oh, it's easy. Get a book, you know. So I got a book. I can't remember who the author was, but I got a book and at the library. And I got my sewing machine out, you know, and there with the book and I had a go and all the fabric got sucked into the machine and I just thought, you know, I can't do this. It's impossible. And then there was a course at City Lit in London, which, funnily enough, I teach that same course now. But anyway, so I went in there for a week, did a week's, I think it was like an evening. So it's like five evenings or something. And I went in there. It's much easier when somebody is there to show you and they've got proper sewing machines that, you know, love doing free motion embroidery. So, of course, we sat down, got on with it, and I was like, wow. And because I'd been thinking about, you know, the drawing and textile techniques and things, I just suddenly thought, ah, now you can draw here with this. So that's how I started. And then I thought, what am I going to draw? I need to draw something. And how am I going to get it? You know, I didn't have a clue how to get it on the fabric and all that. But so I think I took some photographs at a friend's beach hut of all of my people on the beach and sitting around, and then just traced them directly onto some see-through fabric and then stitched them. And then I just got a bit hooked on it then. But because I'd started off as well doing these people sitting around, I don't know why I didn't do something else, why I went for those people. But also one of the other things I did was I took a Dürer drawing of a hand and blew it up really big and then tried to stitch that. So that was quite good because then I could see how you would translate all the marks that he'd made with a pen. You know, how could I translate that into using the sewing machine? And so that kind of showed me a lot about how you've got this machine in the way. You know, when you're drawing with a pencil, it's direct, isn't it? Your hand is kind of moving and the pen moves on the paper. But when you've got a sewing machine, you kind of have to do what the sewing machine wants, don't you? So you sort of, and it just wants to keep going, basically. Just keep going.
I was talking to Harriet about it. There's a couple of things I want to touch on there. But yeah, when you're doing machine embroidery, you're moving the paper and not the pen. I always think it's like the inverse of it, isn't it?
That's a good point. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's so true.
But you've only been doing it for like 15 years. I'm glad to have assisted there. But I've seen the Dürer piece. There's a lot of like cross-hatching. There's a lot of line work in there.
Yeah, because he does loads of that. Yeah.
And so the interesting point is then, as you said previously, it's a continuous line doing machine embroidery. You don't really want to have to stop and start. So you've got to presumably learn to edit your work to get the effects you want without taking the pen off the paper or the paper from under the pen.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, because he does a lot of cross-hatching. And then so just by trying to copy his work revealed to me that you don't want to do that. No, you don't want to do any of that shiny little lines. You just want to keep going. So, yeah, you adapt it so that you can keep going and sort of, so you, that you end up with this very specific kind of effect, don't you? This definitely a sort of type of drawing, contour kind of drawing with lots of just keep going.
Mm. And it's the same with Harriet. Like, the interesting thing about Harriet's work particularly is she's like improv, you know, so she can sit down and do someone's portrait then and there.
Amazing.
Which is it really is. It's the skills that I'm in awe of. I don't know how she does it.
Yeah.
Your work's slightly different, I think. I think yours has that more, I don't know, it's more like a technical drawing. I feel like you do well to capture the people, but you don't necessarily lean into the details. You get the overall piece, the shape of their textures and those kind of things, rather than maybe making sure their nose is exactly right.
Yeah.
And I just wondered whether you can speak about that, because obviously you and Harriet have taken the same principle, drawing people with a machine embroidery, but have gone in different paths.
So she's basically sitting there looking at the person and then drawing them directly from looking, isn't she? Yeah, you like you say, I'm in awe of her ability to do that. I mean, there was an artist whose name, a Japanese woman, and she used to do life drawing, and she used to do hand embroidery directly looking at the figure, you know, and then stitch directly, and she had these amazing life drawings. And again, I used to just think, I don't know how they manage it, because if you're looking at the person and then you've got to move the machine around, it's just amazing, isn't it? So I feel like I'm making life easier for myself by just taking a photograph. But the reason why also I do that is because if I was to draw, sometimes I do draw direct, you know, in a pencil and paper when I'm out and about. So I'm looking at somebody and I draw them, but then it's too quick. And you're capturing a fleeting moment of it. So you've got lots of marks in there, and you know, it creates a great drawing. But I always wanted to get everything, that every detail of the person in there. So I would take the photograph so that then they're not moving, they're still, I've got them captured on a bit of paper, and I can see every button, everything on their clothes. You know, I want to get it all down there. It comes back to that documenting thing we were talking about. You know, you want to document that moment. So I want to get down the every detail of them, their hat, their hair, their clothes, their whatever they're wearing, whatever words they've got, everything, if I can. And I can't do that if I'm trying to draw them and they're sort of moving around, or even if they're sitting still in front of me. But it is, like you say, it does end up looking like a technical drawing, or it looks almost like a machine's done it, I suppose, although a machine has done it, but, you know, it looks like it's been, the machine has done it itself, maybe. That's why I like having all the loose threads then, because that means that you've left in there that evidence of that's done by the hand, but with the machine. Because if I cut them all off, then it really does look like a quite flat, you know, they are quite flat in a way. And I think if you're drawing directly from life, then you've got that life in it. I've kind of flattened them, I think, but the loose threads help then.
Yeah, it's an interesting position, isn't it? In the same way as for some people that have done machine embroidery, they like to make sure there are obvious imperfections.
Yes.
Because there's always that conversation, isn't there, of like, And weirdly, I don't think it would have been the same 10, 20 years ago, but I mean, certainly machines now can kind of do anything. So there is that. But I think it's interesting that you're putting that in, because I always interpreted your use of loose threads as adding like the fluidity or the movement or the spirit kind of into these situations. It's almost like there's some psychic layer thing going on or something. Mm.
I think they need some sort of something to bring the figures out of the canvas and sort of make them, gives them a bit of life, a bit of movement. But also the loose threads. I'm looking over there because I've got a piece on the wall which is got a lot of loose threads on it, and it's consists of 10 drawings of a man walking across the road, and each one is a photograph. So I took lots of photographs. So each image is like 2 seconds on. So it's a bit like a film of him walking along. And there's quite a lot of loose threads just hanging off it all over the place. But they're coming out into the room. They're coming into the space off the piece. And they, but I found that over the years, when I first started doing it, I left the loose threads with the intention of cutting them off. And then I decided I liked them, particularly with that jeweller's hand, because it made his hand look all hairy. And then, so then I left them on. But over the years, so this is like 20 years now of doing this, they've got longer and longer and longer. And then because I've realised over the years that the loose threads are a thing on their own and that you can do something with them. So you can have your stitch drawing and then the loose threads, you can do something else with them. They can be like, they are an extra layer, but then you can play around with them. So you can make them really long so they dangle off the edge of a piece, a bit like dripping paint or something. And then you could pull them really tightly to one side and pin them down. And then just any things like that, you can just play with them. And then you could, because to start with, I had them very, very short. So then they kind of, around the face, I'd have lots of them. And so it'd become so messy around the face, couldn't really see the face. And then I noticed that if I did them longer, they would hang away from the face. They'd still be there, but they would just clear the decks a bit. Although now I really want to do more with more loose threads, so it becomes really messy, and so you can't really see the people so much. So I want to kind of develop them a bit more, just to see what that's like, because I think that would capture some more of the... So this piece I'm thinking on for this flight, where we've got crowds in the Athens airport, I want to develop a lot more loose threads to get across some sense of the sheer busyness and heavingness and, you know, these so many people. Because when it's flattened, it can look really nice. You can just say, oh, yeah, look at that, it's a lot of people, you know. But if I get a lot of loose threads going, then the whole thing becomes buzzing and...
It's like the humidity, but it's not just a weather thing. There's like a human interaction humidity, isn't there? There's people... children crying, people waiting, exasperation, all of those things. And you can place that there, can't you, like a sort of a language layer with the thread.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because when you're actually in a place experiencing something, so you're looking and you can see, but like you say, you can hear, you can smell, you can, and you start to feel anxious maybe because you're waiting for the flight and everybody's a bit anxious, so there's a tenseness. And how can you capture all that in a flat bit of fabric? You know, how do you do it? So you could try and do it through the actual drawing element. You can try and capture expressions on people's faces, maybe, or have some screaming children in it openly going. But even that, then it's still we're still just looking at it, thinking, oh yeah, that scene looks, because we're not in it. So I think trying to bring out these loose threads, I'm going to see what happens, you know. But, you know, I think that would be a way of in getting that across. But also overlapping the people more so that they're all, you know, I've kind of, to start with, I used to have all the people kind of very next to each other, but never on top of each other. I think they were all kind of like neatly placed, really. So I think they need to get a bit more messy.
Well, I noticed that, I mean, a tool you've used for quite a long time in that respect is applique, where you would have almost like pattern shadows of people behind line drawings of people, which to me almost felt akin to there being ghosts or like there were memories of the people that had been there and moved since you'd taken the photo. And then you took that, to me, you took that work even further when you did Crowd Cloud, because then you had all these different layers and suddenly it was more like a diorama piece, wasn't it? Where people at the front, you could walk in between the layers. And so you got that sense of like the busyness of it all.
Yeah, that's true. That piece was an attempt to kind of make it so that you could step into it, into the scene. So you could go in there and walk amongst all these people and be in this weird crowd of see-through. And it was kind of like a cloud. Because they're see-through and they're sort of hovering in the air when you walk around them. And they were, I think, the first kind of bigger pieces. They're like life-size pieces that I did. And I did that by accident because I applied for this exhibition in somewhere, Staffordshire, I think it was. And I sent them some pictures of my work and I'd done this piece which was about 20 centimetres high, like pieces of card in an accordion style, and it stood up on the table and it had these little stitched figures on the panels. So I'd taken a photograph of it, and because it was like stood up on a table and the panels, so it was a close-up, I suppose, and the people at this gallery thought it was a wall and that the table was the floor. And so they said, oh, we love those, you know, those huge figures. And I was like, I haven't. And I had to go back to them. I did give them the measurements, but I went back and said, oh, no, they're only 20 centimetres high. But when they said that, I went back and looked at the picture and I thought, they would be amazing if they were that high. So I scaled them up and did one. And, of course, I realised that when you scale them up, because this picture, it was just a small piece, but in order to recreate that, the actual threads would have to be much thicker.
Mm. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.